Hello, and welcome to Breast Cancer Conversations, a podcast brought to you by SurvivingBreastCancer.org. I'm Laura Carfing, breast cancer survivor and founder of SurvivingBreastCancer.org, a nonprofit organization providing community, education, and resources to empower those diagnosed with breast cancer and their caregivers from day one and beyond. Welcome to our NBC webinar series that takes place every other Wednesday. And today I'm really excited because normally, Abigail, you're giving the introductions and you're talking about our NBC webinar program and you're introducing the panelists, and I'm just kind of behind the scenes doing all the tech stuff. But today we are turning the tables a little bit. And, you know, I feel that there's that saying, right, like to get out of your comfort zone. And so, you know, I feel like this is getting out of our comfort zone, because if you don't know Abigail Johnston, as a change maker, a mover, a shaker, involved in everything. If you're looking for a breast cancer advocate, if you have questions about absolutely anything, she's the connector. She has, you know, so many tentacles everywhere in the breast cancer community. But really, sometimes we actually don't know your full story. We don't know necessarily about your breast cancer diagnosis, living with metastatic disease, being a mom, and all of the work that you're doing. And so, you know, I think this is a fun opportunity to kind of turn the tables a little bit. And I'm super honored to have you on our webinar series, because you are a dear friend and also sitting on our board of directors as well. So, you know, again, you're just, you know, a wealth of knowledge and information. It's a pleasure to have you here tonight in this capacity.
Thank you, Laura. I like the idea of tentacles everywhere. I like that.
Yes. Oh, the octopus or the tentacles everywhere. Exactly. And, you know, and I think that just goes to how actually your advocacy has evolved over the last couple of years as well. So, you know, I wanted to start off as someone who is, you know, being diagnosed with metastatic disease de novo. So right at, well, I'll have you tell your story, because it was kind of de novo, kind of not de novo, which is a big question mark to start off any situation.
It was a big mess.
You're going on 6 years living with metastatic disease. And, you know, we know that this is a disease that does not have a cure, that has very terrible, you know, prognosis and stats. I mean, sometimes we don't even want to talk and look at the stats because we're not a statistic. And right. So, you know, I think to also shine the light on, okay, this is 6 years. Tonight, let's talk about the past and how this happened and what you've been doing up until now. And then also take time towards the end of the conversation to look ahead and see what's on the horizon for you. So that is what I'm thinking for today.
Sounds good. So we can start at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I'm actually originally from Ohio. I think sometimes people forget that I'm from the Midwest, because I shed the veneer of the nice person walking into treatment and doctor's offices and not saying anything. Yeah, shed that a long time ago. I was a little outspoken from the beginning, but breast cancer certainly made that worse. And now I don't sugarcoat anything. But I moved here to Florida, to Orlando, for college, and left briefly for law school, and then came back to Orlando. This is where I met my husband, Elliot. We met online when it was still slightly cool. Like, I don't know if it's so cool anymore. Like, it wasn't, I know people that met in chat rooms when I was in college, and it was still like a, like hush hush, like we met in a chat room. Right. But it became a little more mainstream when we met on.
Yeah, you're like owning it. You're like, we met online. Like,
we did. We totally did. Well, you know how it is. Like, once you get out of college and get into your career, you're only around people in your profession, really.
Exactly.
And I mean, unless you're going out to bars or, you know, sometimes church organ, you know, other things where you're meeting people. But I was only meeting other attorneys, and attorneys are not as much fun as we think we are. So I turned to meeting somebody online. So I met my husband here in Orlando. We had both of our kids here. So Liam just turned 10 on Sunday. Still amazed that I have a child who is a decade old. And then Malcolm is going to be 8 in May. So they were little when I was diagnosed. You know, before I had kids, I left the law firm that I had been working for and started my own firm, because the firm that I was working for didn't have a maternity policy. And I knew I wanted kids. Yeah. And the law firm that I was working for was not super supportive of women. And a lot of law firms are like that. You know, the profession is not really designed to kind of, you know, take a break and come back, which is why there are still so few women at, you know, the higher partner levels of law firms and that sort of thing. So started my own firm, and then we had our kids, but we did go through some fertility issues. Didn't have to get to the point of IVF, but there was a whole lot of shots and medication in order to get pregnant. So I have wondered at various points, because knowing that we have a germline mutation in my family, how it would have been really helpful for my doctors when I was going through fertility treatment to have offered genetic testing, especially given the fact that my mother had breast cancer, but that was never offered. And, you know, I'm not a person that looks back and beats myself up for things, but I see at various points in that timeline where we might have gotten information that could have been extremely valuable later. And we were already going through, you know, all the tests and all, it's very invasive. If anybody's been through it, fertility treatment, you have no privacy. Everything is on the table, literally. But to have offered me genetic testing, even if it hadn't been covered by my insurance, that could have been really helpful information for us as we moved forward. Because
you knew about your genetic mutation, your family history of it prior, like it was known, or?
So my mother is about a 20-year now cancer survivor, thank God. It was DCIS,
yes.
And it has not reoccurred, which is wonderful. And back when she had her treatment, the genes that were known to be associated with breast cancer were really BRCA1 and 2. Like that was really all that was offered. She had testing done and it was negative. So we thought we were in the clear. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I never really, like, I would tell doctors certainly that there was that history in my family, but then I would always say, but my mother's been tested and she's negative.
Right.
And so not really understanding what I know now, which is they're finding new things all the time in genetics, and to rely on that one test that was, you know, now 20 years ago, which would have been like, what, 15 years ago back then, I didn't know that that didn't definitively close the door to that being an issue. So the genetic mutation that is in my family, which is ATM, like you get money from the ATM, that was something that was discovered after my mother's experience with breast cancer. And we did not find out until the mess happened, where we thought I was stage 2, but I was really stage 4. And all the doctors were scratching their heads because none of the tests indicated that.
Right.
So then we did the full
thing. I hear what you're saying then. So as you're going through fertility, you wish someone had brought this up, because that would have been really insightful and helpful information to know then and also moving forward.
100%. So what a lot of people do, especially if they carry BRCA genetic mutation, meaning a really high risk of breast cancer, they will actually do IVF, do genetic testing on the embryos, and select the embryos that don't have the mutation, because you have a 50-50 chance of passing on a genetic mutation to your child when you carry it. There are 6 kids in my family. 4 of us have gotten tested. 2 are positive, 2 are negative. So the, you know, the statistics are holding.
Yeah.
So, you know, but that's what a lot of women who find out about their genetic mutation ahead of having children, they're able to family plan in that way, so that they know they're not passing along the genetic mutation to their children. And I realize there's lots of controversy with doing genetic testing and selecting embryos, and, you know, I have no opinion on any of those things. I'm just saying that if we had known that that could have been an issue, that we might have chosen differently. But again, I don't look back and beat myself up. We made the best decisions we could with the information we had. And I would never, ever do anything not to have my boys. Like, they are the lights of my life. So, but still, I can see that, especially for young women who know that they have a history of breast cancer, knowing that there are fertility, or there are options within the fertility community in order to be able to make decisions to manage that risk, I think is so very, very important. And you know, we were talking about child number three because my husband really wanted a girl. When I felt the lump and started on this whole breast cancer experience. So, you know, and that is a thing that I think a lot of those of us who are diagnosed premenopausal, sometimes doctors don't talk to us about preserving fertility and don't talk about that loss, right? So I have two children, which is amazing, but the door closed on having a third child as part of my treatment. And the term for that, I believe, is secondary infertility. So when you've already dealt with infertility, perhaps had a child like I had two, without any significant issues, but then we had to grieve that change when, you know, they said it just would not be safe for me to consider having another child, and, you know, had a hysterectomy and all of that. So It is a thing that I don't talk about a whole lot because, quite frankly, we had a lot of other things to deal with.
Yeah.
But that is, that it's an issue, even if you have children, to be told the door is closed, you can't do that.
Right.
So anyway,
thank you for sharing that. You know, I think it's sometimes we look at what's visible, right? You're like, oh, well, you have two kids, you have two boys, all the things, right? And, you know, it's really hard for us to kind of even go back in time to be like, you know, that's not what I signed up for. We wanted to have a family of five or whatever the number was, right?
Yeah. Well, and there, to a certain extent, there is grief there in a lot of ways because we were not able to do what my husband really wanted. Like, he always really wanted a little girl. So he gets to love on the nieces, and now we have a great niece, which I can't wrap my head around being a great aunt, but so he gets his snuggles in with our nieces and our great niece, which is good.
Excellent. Excellent. So you started to talk about, you know, when you felt this lump. I think this is really important for viewers and listeners to hone in on, because a lot of times when you're breastfeeding, or, you know, having milk if you're not able to breastfeed or anything, but a lot of things, it can feel lumpy and different and you're not quite sure what's there. And I hear a lot of times, even when you feel that there might be something that could be a lump, such as breast cancer, that a lot of times it'll be like, oh, it might be a clogged duct because you're breastfeeding. It could be all of these other things that are valid as well. But how do we balance the what ifs and could haves and should be's and all of that with my intuition that, no, I felt something and it doesn't feel normal. It wasn't there, you know, last week when I was breastfeeding, so to speak. Right.
Well, and I think there's this big black hole when you are a woman and you are breastfeeding, but there's no doctor that treats your boobs.
There's
a black hole because, like, okay, so you have your OB who, like, did their thing and you had the baby and they're like, bye. And then you have your pediatrician who's focused on the baby, but there's no doctor that specializes in the whole breastfeeding experience. And so, when I discovered this by experiencing a few minor issues with breastfeeding with my older son, we sought out a pediatrician that had a lactation consultant on staff, which is not the norm typically. So International Board Certified Lactation Consultants, IBCLC, is the one profession where there's some licensing requirements. They are a healthcare worker, and they specialize in the things that happen with lactation. So when I was able to breastfeed and it worked amazingly well to the point where I had so much milk, we actually ended up donating 25,000 ounces of breast milk to a milk sharing organization that we have here locally. Hi, Eileen. I love IBCLCs. Thank you for being here. In some foreshadowing that we didn't realize was foreshadowing, the very first person that received my milk was a woman who gave birth to twins and then literally was wheeled down into the chemotherapy suite to have chemotherapy. And, you know, thinking back about that and then thinking about my own experience, again, strange foreshadowing there.
Very
strange. But, so when I felt the lump in January of 2017, I had been nursing and pumping and breastfeeding for just about 4 years. So I had gotten to know my breasts in a very different way. Mm-hmm. And because I was nursing and pumping all the time, every 2 to 3 hours for 4 years straight, I could tell that something was different. Mm-hmm. The area where the cancer was found was actually a place where I had had a clog twice. And so I knew what a clog felt like. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a clog. It felt different. And ironically, it's interesting, and I hope somebody will eventually look into this, but my mother's breast cancer was also in the areas where she had clogs. Who knows what came first, right? The cancer or the clog, right? Like, you know, if things aren't flowing, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know, but it's fascinating to me too, because when you begin breastfeeding, just some, you know, random pieces of knowledge, the ducts in the middle of your breast are recruited first. As you breastfeed mm-hmm. longer, the ducts, you know, all the way around are recruited, right? They become more active mm-hmm. as you breastfeed longer. And so it is. So the cancer that was found in my left breast was very close to the surface. So again, in that kind of the last recruited ducts. Thinking in terms of if I had known that I had a genetic predisposition for breast cancer, I might not have chosen to breastfeed as long as I did, because we know that a high amount of estrogen for a short period of time, i.e. pregnancy, that's okay. That doesn't mm-hmm. increase your risk as much as a long-term consistent bathing the body in estrogen. So birth control, right? That's why birth control is an issue, because you're bathing your body for however many years in extra estrogen. And so, I mean, if you think about it, your estrogen levels are really high when you're breastfeeding too. I really feel passionate about making sure that women understand that breastfeeding, yes, is a longitudinal safety measure for breast cancer. If you've breastfed in a longitudinal meaning over the course of your lifetime, that actually reduces your risk. But in the short term, both pregnancy and breastfeeding actually increases your risk for breast cancer substantially, but for a short period of time. And so I didn't know any of this, right? So when I felt the lump and I knew it was something different, I went to my lactation consultant, Brooke Simmons, who is a lovely person and a wonderful IBCLC here in Orlando. And, you know, I could tell that she was concerned, because she's like, it doesn't feel right. She's like, I want you to go to your doctor, which is exactly the right thing to do for a lactation consultant. Like I think she probably knew that something was pretty wrong.
Yeah.
She didn't scare me. She just said, you need to go to your doctor. And the primary care physician that I still see had gotten an extra certification in lactation and actually was tandem breastfed her children. So when you're breastfeeding two children at once, it's called tandem breastfeeding. And so I went to see her, and she looked me in the eye and she said, I'm 95% sure this is nothing. She said, but given your history, I'm sending you for a mammogram. I was 38 and I had never had a mammogram. I know that, and I know so many people whose doctors were like, it's nothing. It's nothing. Yeah, go home.
Absolutely. And at this time, are you thinking cancer, or are you just like, I have this annoying thing and it's impacting life in other ways? Like, are you thinking cancer at all at this time?
I wasn't. I mean, you know, the only thing that I can say at you know, looking back, is that I was just not going there, right? I don't know if it was my brain was protecting me from drawing that conclusion. My doctor was very confident in saying, you know, 95% sure it's nothing. That was very calming to me.
Yes.
And I am very thankful that I didn't hear you're too young for breast cancer. I didn't hear, put hot compresses on it, or here's some medication so you don't get mastitis, you know, the normal things that people say when it's a clog or when it's not anything significant. So I am very thankful that that did not happen. So I went to my first mammogram. I hate those torture devices. Come on, it was bad. But because I had been nursing and pumping for so long and had so much of a milk supply, even though I pumped before I went in, I sprayed milk all over the machine.
Oh my God.
I mean, when you're squishing them, that's what happens. The milk comes out. So they immediately wanted me to go in for the ultrasound. And then the radiologist that worked at the clinic that I was in came in right away and was like, we want to do a biopsy right now. So my doctor had told me, which again, maybe she had an inkling. She told me, if they want to do a biopsy, I want you to go to a specific person. Don't let the radiologist do the biopsy. Oh. And so, you know, she had a particular way she wanted to do things. And the woman that ended up being my breast surgeon, she's an interventional radiologist as well. And so, you know, I think my primary care physician just wanted me to go to, you know, somebody who was a specialist. And so, you know, again, looking back, yeah, she really knew something was going on. Yeah. So that was my first experience with leaving a medical clinic AMA because, or against medical advice, because they wanted to do the biopsy right then. And I knew, looking back, I know their worry was that I wasn't going to follow up, right? They saw something concerning. And I'm sitting there saying, look, my primary care physician said, go to this person. You know, it was in the evening because I had to do this after work. I'm like, I will call them first thing tomorrow. Like, I promise I'm not going to ignore this. But they sent me into an office to speak with a social worker. Like, I mean, we're talking, they pulled out all the stops to try to get me to stay. Wow. And again, I probably should have been flipping out at this point because of how seriously they were taking it. But, you know, my doctor told me I was supposed to do something a certain way, and I am a very compliant patient. I mean, I really am a compliant patient most of the time. So that was a Thursday night. The following Monday, I'm in the surgeon's office and was not expecting her to do a biopsy right then and there in the office. Yeah. But, you know, she did the exam, saw what was going on, and did the biopsy right then and there. So it took a bit for the results to come back, but it was April 8th of 2017. Some things just stick in your brain, right? And when I found out that the biopsy had come back positive for breast cancer, and it was the same subtype that my mother had, which was hormone positive, very sensitive to estrogen, very sensitive to progesterone. And at the time, even though I think now I was probably HER2 low from the beginning, but it came back HER2 negative at that point in 2017. We didn't know a whole lot about HER2 low. So that kicked everything into high gear. And within that week, I had met with a medical oncologist, a radiation oncologist. You know, the woman that gave me the diagnosis was the breast surgeon. So, I mean, I walked out of that initial finding out I had cancer with a long list of people to see and things to do. And I know that a lot of people find out that they have cancer in different ways. I was incredibly blessed to find out that I had cancer with my husband sitting next to me, with the surgeon that eventually did my surgery. And I am thankful that that happened. And I realized that that's not everybody's experience. I didn't find out randomly with a phone call or a portal or something like that. I was with somebody who helped me develop a plan right away. So we put off the surgery for a little bit, just my brother was getting married and, you know, things were happening and all of that. So I had a modified lumpectomy. So because the tumor was very deep, they had to scrape out so much tissue to get clear margins. So what they did was, so they actually, you know, cut the skin, lifted everything up, rearranged all the tissue. So they took tissue from the right side to fill in the left side. And then I got a lift and, you know, it was nipple sparing and all of that. So, you know, thinking, okay, this is going to be a one and done, right? Like, let's go for aesthetically pleasing and all of those things. One funny thing that happened. So because I had been nursing for so long, I was a double D because there was so much milk. And by the time I got to surgery, because I had to dry up my milk and it took a really long time to do that, I was down to barely a B. And so... they were actually a little, they told me afterwards, but they were a little concerned that I wouldn't have enough tissue to actually do the surgery, because the surgery is for people with larger breasts. But, you know, I didn't think to tell them, like, this is not my normal size.
Didn't seem important at the time.
The other thing that didn't seem important as this was going on was that I was limping. I was in a pretty crazy amount of pain in my back and in my legs. And to me, my legs had nothing to do with my breasts, right? Like those body parts did not seem connected to me. So I didn't say anything. They sent off the sample to get an Oncotype score. I know there's MammaPrint as well. My doctor picked Oncotype and it came back in the gray area. So, for somebody who is premenopausal, the gray area used to be, 27. So I think it was 25 to 30 or something. So I was like right in the middle of the gray area. And, you know, we sat down with the medical oncologist, we sat down with the form, you know, the chart and the information you get. And the information that they had was that it would have reduced my chances of reoccurrence by about 12%. And that seemed like enough to choose to do chemo. And again, we were thinking this is going to be a blip. This is going to be, you know, we're going to do this and then we're done. So got my port. We're in June at this point. And I started Adriamycin and Cytoxan, which is not a fun chemo regimen for anybody who's had the Red Devil. It is a Red Devil. It's not fun.
I was in that one too. There's empathy there.
Yeah. And the nurse in my oncologist's office made a mistake and checked the box to have my tumor markers tested. So tumor markers are just proteins in the blood that are given off when different things are happening, like cancer is growing or like cancer is in your bones. And it was a mistake. It was a medical mistake. It was not standard operating procedure. It was not standard of care. It was not what they usually did. And you know, I'm very thankful for that because the test came back really high. And so in the fog of the day after my first chemo treatment, the doctor called and said, something came back wonky in your blood and we need you to go in for a bone scan and a CT scan. And, you know, I didn't know anything. Nobody knows anything at that point in the experience, right? And I'm like, oh, okay. And I'm, you know, still on the Benadryl and the pre-meds and still totally out of it.
So and you're not about, either. It's not like you've gone through chemo before. You're like, oh, maybe this is just common practice. Like you have more tests. I was telling someone too, I was like, I just show up when you tell me to go. Like, who do I need to see? What's the appointment? I'll just, you know?
And at that point we were on autopilot, right?
Yeah. There was
so much going on. And so I went in, you know, thinking, oh, this is going to be nothing, no big deal. So the morning of June 27th of 2017, I got a call from the doctor's office and they said, the results came back and we need to talk to you in person. Just come whenever you can.
Oh.
And I was preparing for a big hearing and called my husband and was like, yeah, they said this. It's probably no big deal. Don't worry about it. Whatever. Like, that's not what doctor's offices say. Like, this is a big deal. Yeah. So he came and got me, took me to my hearing. That was actually the last hearing that I handled as a practicing attorney. I won, you know, very important to.
Yes. Thank you for sharing. the facts out there. Let people know.
Exactly. Just need to put that out there. And then my husband took me to the doctor's appointment. And again, in my doctor's office with my husband sitting next to me, the medical oncologist who I hadn't liked the first time I met him because he has a daughter my age. And so I felt like he was a little paternalistic.
Sure.
he patted me on the knee a couple times and I was like, oh no, this is not okay. But the kindest, most gentle man, the perfect person to say, and he said it this way. He said, when we thought you were stage two, we were talking about something else is going to kill you, right? This is not going to kill you. Now that you're stage four, it's going to kill you. And that, I mean, he just said it very matter-of-factly. And then he laid out some statistics. I mean, again, I look back and I'm like, best possible way of finding out such a horrific thing with a man who was incredibly compassionate, who gave us the information that we needed. And I mean, I had his cell phone from the very first meeting. He was very, very accessible. He retired because, you know, of course, the people who do these kinds of things burn out. And so we decided we had to, we finished Adriamycin and Cytoxan, but in the middle of that, they told me to stop walking. because my right femur was quite literally about like on the cusp of shattering. So I had the tumor in my breast never got bigger than 2.5 centimeters. The tumor in my right femur was 5.5 centimeters.
Wow.
So, and when we looked at, you know, later on in the surgeon's office, looked at the actual x-rays, and because we did skeletal studies and bones, I mean, I MRIs, all kinds of scans. Mm-hmm. There were thousands of mets in my bones.
What?
Thousands. What? There were places that you couldn't even see white anymore on the x-rays. It was so full of cancer, which is why they were like, they, you know, you have to get off your feet. Like if I had tripped and fallen, it was a very good chance my femur would have broken. And so within a week of finding out that I was stage four, I was in surgery getting rods, titanium rods put in both of my femurs. We decided to do both because there's some score. I forget the name of the score, but it's how they figure out, should you have your bone pinned or not, right? Have the rod in the bone. And my right femur, 100% qualified. But my left femur was very close. And so what they were worried about was if I was thinking my left leg was my good leg, right? As I was recovering, that it wasn't going to be strong enough to withstand, you know, having to go through physical therapy and all of that. So in the middle of chemo, I had chemo on a Friday. The same day, unfortunately, I found out that, so this was chemo number two. So chemo number one was when I found out that the tumor markers were high. Chemo number two, surgery, chemo number three. So we just did it on the off week of chemo and just kept going. So finished up with Adriamycin and Cytoxin, you know, we did radiation because I had to do radiation to my back, radiation to my legs, and then went to systemic therapy. So I went to Ibrance as my first line in the metastatic setting. So it took months to figure out, oh, and then I had a hysterectomy, and you know, 2017 was just, I don't even remember what happened in 2017 other than those things.
Oh my gosh.
So that was my first line in the metastatic setting. Although sometimes it's hard to like differentiate, you know, which line is which, because I was already stage four. And my doctor told me the tumor board was entirely stumped. How could I have such an incredibly high disease load, so many mets already in my bones, and yet have an oncotype score in the gray area? No one's ever been able to answer that question. But, you know, I think unfortunately what it really drove home to me was these tests that we get, the blood tests, the scans, all the things that we get, nothing is infallible and nothing really gives you the whole story. And so I have learned over the past 6 years that you don't trust any one test. You don't trust any one opinion. I worked really hard to get lots of second opinions, third opinions, fourth opinions, fifth opinions.
Yes.
Because at the end of the day, there's really nothing definitive set in stone in this medical experience. There just isn't. There's statistics, there's probabilities, there's likelies, there's, you know, all kinds of good things, but there's somebody always in that small percentage that doesn't fit. And I ended up in that small percentage that doesn't fit many times. You know, ATM, the genetic germline mutation we have in our family, is only associated with a moderate risk of breast cancer. In fact, it's only recently that they've updated the screening guidelines for people who have this mutation, because there wasn't enough data to even know how prevalent it is or how significant it is. And so now they're finding out that there are certain, you know, when you have a genetic mutation, it's at some point on the gene, right? And ATM is a gigantic gene, apparently. It's like twice or 10 times as big as BRCA or something like that.
Wow.
So there's lots of opportunity in this gene for there to be something wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the mutations that I have is associated with a higher risk of breast cancer, not necessarily a moderate risk, but we didn't know that.
Yeah.
So now I understand that a whole lot more. And because of my stage four diagnosis, my doctor did the full genetic panel, and that's how we found out. So we were able to then, my mom got retested, redid her genetic testing, found out that was where it came from, right? That was the side of the family that it came from. And then my uncle is positive, cousins are positive. One of my sisters is a pre-vivor. She was positive for ATM, and so she's taken steps to reduce her risk by having a prophylactic double mastectomy. The information that we found out because of my diagnosis has meant that there are people in my family who now have information to be able to make different decisions. Mm-hmm. I mean, not better, maybe, but different
decisions. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And so I want to go back to, because you, and I appreciate you giving, you know, the accolades to how you found out about your initial diagnosis at 2 and then your metastatic diagnosis and the way in which the, you know, bedside manner, so to speak, was delivered. It was in person. And you also had your husband there with you. So I want to ask, how was he through all of this? I know a lot of times we focus so much on the quote unquote patient who's going through the cancer, but what about the caregivers or the significant others or other aspects like of the family that are affected by this too? What was going through his mind during all of this?
So it is interesting that my husband has been in the role of caregiver previously. So my father-in-law had 3 strokes, and my husband was his primary caretaker for a long time before he went into a nursing home. I actually met my father-in-law on our 3rd date because he had just recently moved into the nursing home and he had fallen, and we had to go make sure he was okay. So caregiving for my father-in-law was a huge part of my husband's life. And then that became a big part of our lives as well, because we were, visiting him regularly and keeping an eye on all the medical stuff. So I think that in a lot of ways that prepared him, again, to understand, like, doctors don't say just come, right? He knew that was not
right.
So, you know, we both are very analytical, and we begin with the project management piece, right? You know, doing it very cerebrally and working through it. But the one thing that I insisted of him at the very beginning was that he get a therapist and he stay in therapy for as long as that was a good idea. And so, because the thing that changes in a relationship when one partner is ill is that partner is not somebody that the other person can lean on. And for somebody like my husband, who is not, he's not an extrovert, we're both introverts. So, you know, it's not like he had a huge support system, although the people that are around him have been hugely supportive. So I think that was one of the best things that he's done. And that's been helpful over the years as he's had to process things as well. But I know I vividly remember walking out of the doctor's office after, you know, he told us that I was stage 4, and we were both crying so hard. I was like, I can't drive. Like, you know, we cried all the way home. And there is such a significant amount of grief in that, you know, our lives were turned completely upside down. And so, because I haven't always been able to be as supportive as I would like to be, just because of dealing with so many things myself, it has been really helpful for him to have somebody else that's just purely in his corner, to help him process and think through these things. But we have a lot of conversations. You know, our estate planning has had to change completely. You know, the way that we live our lives, the things that we do, everything has had to change substantially. And that has put a much larger burden on him.
Yeah.
You know, he really can't lose his job because we need health insurance. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that become a whole lot more important. So, but I think one of the best things that has really helped him is having somebody in his corner that can help him process through all of the things that he's carrying as well.
It's such an important point. And it's never too late to get a social worker or a therapist or a psychiatrist, at any phase, because I hear a lot of times it's natural for, I think, the oncologist or surgeon who's ever delivering this news to you to say, you know, here's a list of therapists, we have someone on call or something like that. And I'm not sure if the gut reaction is like, yes, sign me up. I'm just still processing all of this news. And later on in the process, then you're like, oh, now what would be a really good time for me to talk to someone professionally?
And 100%. So, yeah. But then the thing is that it's got to be the right professional. And I know a lot of people in the MBC community will connect with a therapist who doesn't know how to help him. Mm-hmm. And that has been something that I've struggled with. I've seen a variety of people who are like, I have nothing to help you. Like, you're already doing all the coping mechanisms that I would suggest to you. And while I appreciate being told the truth,
yeah,
at the same time, it's hard because then you start to think, oh, well, this must just be a lot more significant than even I realize. So the therapist that my husband is seeing, his daughter had had cancer.
Oh.
And so uniquely sensitive to somebody who would be caregiving, you know, just because he's gone through it himself with his daughter. Yes. So I do think that 100% getting a mental health professional at any point is a good idea. I'm fully in favor of that. Yes. I'm also fully in favor of making sure that that person has experience with cancer patients. And if you are living with MBC, that they have experience dealing with other, it doesn't have to be metastatic breast cancer, but other metastatic cancers.
Yes.
So that they have a framework for being able to know how to help you, because you learn things in school, certainly. Mm-hmm. My father is a licensed mental health counselor, and I see how his perspective has changed in, you know, my mother being a survivor, my sister being a previvor, my experience. He looks at things differently now, mm-hmm. and helps people in a different way, having understood the cancer experience differently. Yeah. So anyway, just a small clarification.
Oh, no, thank you. That's really important, right? So not just finding anybody, but someone who is can relate to what you're going through and has that experience as well.
Absolutely. And I find that most social workers at cancer centers will have a list of the therapists mm-hmm. that they often work with. And so that's what I usually suggest to people. If they're looking for somebody, don't just open the yellow pages. Don't just, or does anybody have the yellow pages anymore? I don't know.
Yellowpages.com, of course. No.
Don't just go to a random person or, like, you know, just somebody because they're on your insurance. You know, that is an investment in your mental health. And so getting to the right person, I think, is really important, or it has been important for me as well.
Wonderful. So I really appreciate this deep dive. I'm really going from, I think, all of the issues sometimes that we don't talk about. And I think it's so beautiful for you to share and reflect on your experience having lived with MBC now for 6 years, to go back. And I know all of us can go right back to that date, that time, that feeling. What was it, raining outside, the smell in the air? Like, it is crystallized. And on so many levels, the biopsy, getting the phone calls, so many dates, as you were mentioning. And now that you've come 6 years, right? So now you're here in this kind of new chapter. How are you doing now?
So I'm on my fifth line of treatment, and over the summer in 22, so last year, was the first time that I got a scan that said no evidence of active disease. So for most people, they get, you know, no evidence of disease. But for those of us with bone mets, the marks on our bones never go away. So they're always there. They can always see something there. They're just not active. And so it's a kind of a weird place to be in, because, you know, I was always hanging on to stability. I was always getting scans every 3 months. And now my doctor is scheduling my scans every 6 months, which is amazing. And I'm fully aware of how amazing that really is. But it's a very different space to be in. Not quite the same as going through active treatment and then nothing, because I still get monthly blood work. You know, I still have all these other things going on, but it's been an interesting space, because I did IV chemo again last year when the cancer had spread to my liver. So for 4.5 years, it stayed in the bones. And then in January of 22, it had spread to my liver. So we went back into chemo, and then I've been able to be on oral chemotherapy since I finished IV chemotherapy. So it's a weird space to be in that my side effects are really manageable or really under control, thank God. Mm-hmm. And I'm starting to feel a lot better after coming out of that second round of chemo. My body did not take it as well as the first time. Just, I think after all this treatment, our bodies get tired, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So So it's a weird space to be in. I have lost so many dear friends over the past almost 6 years.
Yeah.
And there is an element of, whether you call it survivor's guilt or, you know, whatever you want to call it, but there's an element of why me and not them. Right. And, you know, I have a dear friend here locally who has the same exact genetic mutation that I do. She has the same subtype that I do. Although things have changed for her, but you know, I see how the cancer has just gotten out of control for her and it is under control for me. Mm-hmm. So that is a rough place to be in. And, you know, each time I lose somebody that I've gotten close with, you know, they take a piece of my heart with them. And there are times where I am just like, I am done. I don't want to know anybody with breast cancer anymore. I don't want to be in this anymore. But, I keep coming back to the significance and the value of the really genuine and authentic people that I've met and how my life is so much better for knowing them. So I keep getting pulled back because that has been the most significant silver lining of this experience is the people that I've met that I never would have met otherwise. So it's a weird place. As far as that goes. Otherwise, my kids are thriving. They're running everywhere. We're basically chauffeurs at this point in our lives. You know, I consistently have to tell my doctors, like, we have to fit whatever you want to do within the hours of 8 and 3, because, you know, I have to drop off my kids and pick up my kids. So it's a very busy time of life, but, that mental health piece of, and the struggle of continuing to connect with people who are also living with something that will end their lives. So not only is it losing the person, but it's the triggering of that'll be me at some point. So I don't have any magic words of dealing with it. It's just, you know, it's something that I have to carry. It's something that I have to deal with, and talking to other people who feel the same way is helpful. But it's heavy. It's really heavy, you know, going to a funeral every couple of weeks.
Right. It's like, it's your reality, right? Where it's our realities, right? Where, what is it? Yeah. Is it 118 women or people with breast cancer, metastatic disease die a day? Is that the number now? 119?
I think that's in the US, right? Mm-hmm. So worldwide it's more, but yeah, we're still losing over 40,000, like 43,000, 44,000 people a year to MBC. And that is one of also the reasons that I get pulled back into advocacy, because there is still not enough money going to metastatic research. There is still so much money being poured into, you know, awareness and prevention. And I'm not saying that those things are not important, but the trajectory that I have seen over the past 6 years is medication that is developed for people who are living with metastatic disease is then tested for early stage people and is often found to be hugely effective. And so in my view, if anybody's listening that has any money, we should treat this like triage. You treat and you focus on the people who are the worst off that you can help. And you let the people, the walking wounded, the people who are okay for now, you address them second. And that sounds terrible to say, but I have seen over the past 6 years, the first medication that I was on in 2017 was Ibrance. It's a CDK4/6 inhibitor. It was approved in 2017 by the FDA for treatment in the metastatic setting. CDK4/6 inhibitors are now being given to people in the early stage setting.
Yes.
And it's preventing the cancer from coming back after they've gone through treatment for an early stage diagnosis. And so to me, logically, it only makes sense to develop the medication for the people who need it the most, but then it trickles down and it helps everybody.
Exactly.
So So that's why I stay in advocacy. That's why I, you know, meet with my legislators. That's why I do the things in a lot of ways that we've done on a larger scale, because there is still not enough money going into metastatic research. Now, I know some of the numbers have come up, but when I was initially diagnosed, it was less than 5% of the money going into cancer went into metastatic research. It's changed. It's gotten more, but it is still nowhere where it needs to be, in my view. Right. Nor are we counted, right? The SEER database that counts people with breast cancer, if you've had an early stage diagnosis and then you're one of the 30% that progress to being metastatic, you're not counted.
Yeah,
right. I'm not counted, right? Because my initial documentation sent to Florida doesn't participate in the federal database, but here in Florida, I am listed as having stage 2 breast cancer because we don't count people with metastatic cancer here in Florida either, unless it's a true de novo diagnosis, which mine wasn't really a true de novo diagnosis.
So you can already see the like web of not complete information to be able to make your case and advocate for more.
Exactly. Well, and the thing is that counting people and understanding how many people are really living with metastatic disease, that leads to funding. That leads to research. But all we can do is extrapolate based on the information that's reported and then the death certificates. You know, they can find, you know, they can extrapolate and use statistics to figure out that's where we get the approximately 44,000 people die in the US of metastatic breast cancer every year. A lot of those are estimates because we're not counted in the best way. And there's many nuances to that lots of people are working on, but the more that I live with this disease, the more that I deal with the healthcare system, for better or for worse, the more I see that there are just so many ways that people are lost in our system. When you make healthcare a profit-run enterprise, then things happen that are not always best for people. Some of you may have seen Elaine Shatner just published her book, and you should all get it. It's called From Whispers to Shouts, and it talks about the history of breast cancer. But one of the things that she pointed out, which I thought was so interesting, was it was about in the 1950s, 1960s in there, when MBAs began to run, people with MBAs began to run healthcare organizations. And the doctors, the MDs, were no longer running the show. They might be the medical director, but they're not administrators. They're not the people, you know, the people with medical degrees are no longer the ones that are running healthcare. And in her view, which really resonates with me, that's when things really begin to shift.
Yeah.
Really begin to shift. I have to say too, that there were lawyers who were very smart at that point. And around that time, there was legislation passed that said that no non-lawyers could ever own a law firm. And I never understood why. And after reading the book, I'm like, now I understand. Now I understand.
Fascinating.
So when you have somebody who's focused on the money, when you have somebody who's focused on profit, when you have, you know, people who are making decisions who, you know, never went to medical school, they have different sets of priorities.
Yes.
And I have seen that over and over and over again, where policies are created and they make perfect sense at a high level. They make perfect sense from a, you know, streamline the process. They make perfect sense in the minds of the people who are, you know, writing the paychecks and all of that, which is very important.
Yeah, absolutely.
But when it comes to the patients having to experience the protocols, the procedures, whatever, there are often many unintended consequences. Yes. To that. And I'll just give one example. At the previous medical center that I was at down in Miami, they created a new protocol for you had to get blood work separately, not sitting in the chemo chair. And the end result, or the reason for that, you know, they needed to turn over the chairs, they needed to streamline the process, people might have to sit there for hours waiting for labs. There were lots of reasons why it made sense. But for somebody like me, all that meant was instead of having one stick into my body once a month, it was two. And maybe that's okay for somebody who's coming in for, you know, a short duration of treatment, you know, five sticks becomes 10, or if you're coming in once a year, right? For me, that meant double amount of sticks, and I'm looking at, you know, the years going out in front of me. So I was able to get a exempted from that policy. But it's just, that's just a good example of mm-hmm. let's look through how this might affect somebody who's stage four, right? Okay. It will affect somebody differently. Again, if they're coming in for that concentrated period of treatment and then they're done, you know, getting a couple of extra sticks in that, maybe not such a big deal. But for people like me who are looking at, you know, doing this for life and hopefully longer rather than shorter, it turned out to be a much bigger deal. So I just, you know, if anybody who's in healthcare, an administrator who's listening, you got to talk to the patients, you got to ask the patients, and you gotta really look at what they experience on a day-to-day basis, because so much of our healthcare is just, it is not patient-centered.
It's frustrating at best. Yes.
Yes. And don't get me started on prior authorizations. I know doctors hate them too, but oh my goodness.
I know. Well, we clearly are just scratching the surface, but I feel like this evening was such a rich conversation for you to walk us through your diagnosis. I know we skipped the whole middle chunk of, you know, lines 2, 3, and 4. So that'll be for a follow-up, of course. I'll invite you back, Abigail. I know who to speak to. But, but I think it's just beautiful too, like to take the time and take an opportunity like tonight to really see where we've been and how much we have gone through, how much we have endured, where we are now, acknowledging what our bodies are capable of doing and what they've been through and what they continue to go through. And so I thank you for sharing your story with me, with our listeners, with our viewers, and for really just being open about everything that you're experiencing. So thank you for that.
One thing that really helped me at the very beginning and really all along the way is hearing other people's experiences. I think there's almost nothing more powerful than somebody's story. Yes. And if somebody gets genetic testing or asks their doctor about something because they heard somebody talking about it, I mean, I think that's why we do advocacy, right? We do it so that people can be more knowledgeable, so people can walk into their doctor's office armed with more information than I had. Yes. That really does make it worth it in the end. And I do have a couple of blog posts on my blog, No Half Measures, where I lay out in probably excruciating detail all of my different lines of treatment if anybody is interested.
Yes.
I do tend to do things a little bit outside the box. We've done things that are not FDA approved and that sort of thing. But you know, I think it's just really important for every patient to realize that when they walk into the doctor's office, their experience and their knowledge of their body is just as important as the medical information that the doctor is bringing, because the doctor is not inside your body. The doctor does not know how, you know, you experience certain side effects versus others. And as I've understood that, I need to understand that that's my part, right? I always used to tell people when I was practicing law, they bring the facts, I bring the law. We can't do this alone. Like, we have to do this together. And I really believe that's exactly the same way as medical treatment.
Yes.
The doctors are knowledgeable. Yes, they should be respected, and no doctor should be abused in any way. You know, things are not their fault necessarily, but I think that we need to get away from thinking that doctors know everything. Doctors give their opinions based on their experience and their training and everything else, but they're human beings. And patients bring the, you know, the lived experience, how you respond to certain medications, how you feel in your body.
Yes.
And that's just as important as the medical information. So I hope maybe somebody will take that away today.
Yes.
That your experience of a side effect or how you feel or how things are going for you, tell your doctors that, speak up for yourself. At the end of the day, patients are the only ones who actually make decisions. Nothing can happen without our consent, right? Nobody can give us medication without our consent. Nobody can do a procedure without our consent. And yes, it's very overwhelming because you don't know enough to make good decisions, but understanding that you have that power when you walk into the doctor's office, so that there's not as much of the power differential. Because I think a lot of people walk into a doctor's office and are just like, just tell me what to do.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's how medical mistakes happen, for good or for ill.
Well, this has been amazing. Thank you so much, Abigail. Thank you for all of our watchers who are watching us on Facebook and on YouTube. And again, this is part of our every other Wednesday webinar series. You can always RSVP to get reminders about our webinar series on our website, survivingbreastcancer.org/events. Abigail, I will be sure to link to your blog and your website, No Half Measures. So for all those people who aren't familiar, can read up on all of the details. You post quite regularly. And so that's always nice to kind of get updates on what's happening in your world. And I'm looking forward to kind of celebrate. We just had the equinox, I think, yesterday. So I'm really excited to like celebrate spring with you. So thank you for joining us tonight.
Absolutely. And I just want to remind everybody too, the NBC Leadership Committee of SBC is doing lots of things in the background, and our thematic organization for the rest of this year is all about surviving survivorship. The whole label survivor doesn't really resonate with me just because I'll never be past cancer, but we are in this survivorship space, right? Yeah. We are surviving with the cancer. And then there's all the things that go along with that, all the regular, normal human being things. And so we will be having a workshop over the summer and other episodes on this series, just really examining this whole idea of surviving survivorship.
Yes, thank you. And thank you everyone for listening to our show. I would like to acknowledge that all of the information on our podcast are from personal experiences and are not a substitute for professional medical advice. You should always contact your medical care team. Our podcasts are made possible because of donations from listeners like you, so please feel free to make a contribution through survivingbreastcancer.org/donate. And there are so many ways to get involved with our nonprofit and our organization, not just through listening to the podcast, but through all of our virtual programming. So you can check out all of our lineups by hopping over to survivingbreastcancer.org/events. And as always, all of our programs, services, and resources are absolutely free. Thanks again, and keep on thriving.